There's one more thing to tell you about Mr. Jingles before moving on to the arrival of William Wharton, which was when the cyclone really touched down on E Block. A week or so after the incident of the peppermint candies, around the time when we'd pretty much decided Delacroix wasn't going to feed his pet to death, in other words, the Frenchman called me down to his cell. I was on my own, for the time being, brutal over at the commissary for something, and according to the regs, I was not supposed to approach a prisoner in such circumstances. But since I probably could have shot-putted Delacroix 20 yards one-handed on a good day, I decided to break the rule and see what he wanted. "Watch this, Boss Edgecombe," he said. "You're going to see what Mr. Jingles can do." He reached behind the cigar box and brought up a small wooden spool. "Where'd you get that?" I asked him, although I supposed I knew. There was really only one person he could have gotten it from. "Oh, toot toot," he said, "watch this." I was already watching, and could see Mr. Jingles in his box, standing up with his small front paws propped on the edge, his black eyes fixed on the spool Delacroix was holding between the thumb and first finger of his right hand. I felt a funny little chill go up my back. I had never seen a mere mouse attend to something with such sharpness, with such intelligence, and I never have since. I don't really believe that Mr. Jingles was a supernatural visitation, and if I have given you that idea, I'm sorry, but I have never doubted that he was a genius of his kind. Delacroix bent over and rolled the threadless spool across the floor of his cell. It went easily, like a pair of wheels connected by an axle. The mouse was out of its box in a flash and across the floor after it, like a dog chasing after a stick. I exclaimed with surprise, and Delacroix smiled. The spool hit the wall and rebounded. Mr. Jingles went around it and pushed it back to the bunk, switching from one end of the spool to the other whenever it looked like it was going to veer off course. He pushed the spool until it hit Delacroix's foot. Then it looked up at him for a moment, as if to make sure Delacroix had no more immediate tasks for it, a few arithmetic problems to solve, perhaps, or some Latin to parse. Apparently satisfied on this score, it went back to the cigar box and settled down in it again. "You taught him that," I said. "Yes, sir, Boss Edgecombe," Delacroix said, his smile only slightly dissembling. "He fetch it every time. Smart as hell, ain't he?" "And the spool?" I asked. "How did you know to fetch that for him, Eddie?" "He whispered in my ear that he wanted," Delacroix said serenely, "same as he whispered his name." Delacroix showed all the other guys his mouse's trick, all except Percy. To Delacroix didn't matter that Percy had suggested the cigar box and procured the cotton with which to line it. Delacroix was like some dogs. Kick them once, and they never trust you again, no matter how nice you are to them. I can hear Delacroix now, yelling, "Hey, you guys, come and see what Mr. Jingles can do!" And them going down in a blue suit cluster, Brutal, Harry, Dean, even Bill Dodge. All of them had been properly amazed, too, the same as I had been. 3 or 4 days after Mr. Jingles started doing the trick with the spool, Harry Terwilliger rummaged through the arts and crafts stuff we kept in the restraint room, found the Crayolas, and brought them to Delacroix with a smile that was almost embarrassed. "I thought you might like to make that spool different colors," he said. "Then your little pal would be like a circus mouse or something."
"A circus mouse,"
Delacroix said, looking completely rapturously happy. I suppose he was completely happy, maybe for the first time in his whole miserable life.
"That just what he is, too, a circus mouse. When I get out of here, he gonna make me rich like in a circus. You see if he don't."
Percy Wetmore would no doubt have pointed out to Delacroix that when he left Cold Mountain, he'd be riding in an ambulance that didn't need to run its siren. But Harry knew better. He just told Delacroix to make the spool as colorful as he could, as quick as he could, because he'd have to take the crayons back after dinner. Del made it colorful, all right. When he was done, one end of the spool was yellow, the other end was green, and the drum in the middle was firehouse red. We got used to hearing Delacroix trumpet,
"Maintenant, messieurs et mesdames, Cirque présentement les mouses amusant et amaisant."
That wasn't exactly it, but it gives you an idea of that stew-pot French of his. Then he'd make this sound way down in his throat, I think it was supposed to represent a drum roll, and fling the spool. Mr. Jingles would be after it in a flash, either nosing it back or rolling it with his paws. That second way really was something you would have paid to see in a circus, I think. Delacroix and his mouse's brightly colored spool were our chief amusements at the time that John Coffey came into our care and custody, and that was the way things remained for a while. Then my urinary infection, which had lain still for a while, came back, and William Wharton arrived, and all hell broke loose. Chapter 10. The dates have mostly slipped out of my head. I suppose I could have my granddaughter, Danielle, look some of them out of the old newspaper files, but what would be the point? The most important of them, like the day we came down to Delacroix's cell and found the mouse sitting on his shoulder, or the day William Wharton came on the block and almost killed Dean Stanton, would not be in the papers anyway. Maybe it's better to just go on as I have been. In the end, I guess the dates don't matter much if you can remember the things you saw and keep them in the right order. I know that things got squeezed together a little. When Delacroix's DOE papers finally came to me from Curtis Anderson's office, I was amazed to see that our Cajun pal's date with old Sparky had been moved up from when we had expected, a thing that was almost unheard of, even in those days, when you didn't have to move half a heaven and all the earth to execute a man. It was a matter of 2 days, I think, from the 27th of October to the 25th. Don't hold me to it exactly, but I know that's close. I remember thinking that Toot was going to get his Corona box back even sooner than he had expected. Wharton, meanwhile, got to us later than expected. For one thing, his trial ran 4 or 5 days longer than Anderson's usually reliable sources had thought it would. When it came to Wild Billy, nothing was reliable, we would soon discover, including our time-tested and supposedly foolproof methods of prisoner control. Then, after he had been found guilty, that much at least went according to the script, he was taken to Indianola General Hospital for tests. He had had a number of supposed seizures during the trial, twice serious enough to send him crashing to the floor, where he lay shaking and flopping and drumming his feet on the boards. Wharton's court-appointed lawyer claimed he suffered from epilepsy spells and had committed his crimes while of unsound mind. The prosecution claimed the fits were the sham acting of a coward desperate to save his own life. After observing the so-called epilepsy spells at first hand, the jury decided the fits were an act. The judge concurred, but ordered a series of pre-sentencing tests after the verdict came down. God knows why, perhaps he was only curious. It's a blue-eyed wonder that Wharton didn't escape from the hospital, and the irony that Warden Moore's wife, Melinda, was in the same hospital at the same time did not escape any of us. But he didn't. They had him surrounded by guards, I suppose, and perhaps he still had hopes of being declared incompetent by reason of epilepsy, if there is such a thing. He wasn't. The doctors found nothing wrong with his brain, physiologically at least, and Billy the Kid Wharton was at last bound for Cold Mountain. That might have been around the 18th. It's my recollection that Wharton arrived about 2 weeks after John Coffey, and a week or so before Delacroix walked the Green Mile. The day our new psychopath joined us was an eventful one for me. I woke up at 4 that morning with my groin throbbing and my penis feeling hot and clogged and swollen. Even before I swung my feet out of bed, I knew that my urinary infection wasn't getting better as I had hoped. It had been a brief turn for the better, that was all, and it was over. I went out to the privy to do my business. This was at least 3 years before we put in our first water closet, and had gotten no further than the wood pile at the corner of the house when I realized I couldn't hold it any longer. I lowered my pajama pants just as the urine started to flow, and that flow was accompanied by the most excruciating pain of my entire life. I passed a gallstone in 1956, and I know people say that is the worst. But that gallstone was like a touch of acid indigestion compared to this outrage. My knees came unhinged, and I fell heavily onto them, tearing out the seat of my pajama pants when I spread my legs to keep from losing my balance and going face first into a puddle of my own piss. I still might have gone over if I hadn't grabbed one of the woodpile logs with my left hand. All that, though, could have been going on in Australia, or even on another planet. All I was concerned with was the pain that had set me on fire. My lower belly was burning, and my penis, an organ which had gone mostly forgotten by me, except when providing me the most intense physical pleasure a man can experience, now felt as if it was melting. I expected to look down and see blood gushing from its tip, but it appeared to be a perfectly ordinary stream of urine. I hung on to the woodpile with one hand and put the other across my mouth, concentrating on keeping my mouth shut. I did not want to frighten my wife awake with a scream. It seemed that I went on pissing forever, but at last the stream dried up. By then the pain had sunk deep into my stomach and my testicles, biting like rusty teeth. For a long while, it might have been as long as a minute, I was physically incapable of getting up. At last the pain began to abate, and I struggled to my feet. I looked at my urine already soaking into the ground, and wondered if any sane god could make a world where such a little bit of dampness could come at the cost of such horrendous pain. I would call in sick, I thought, and go see Dr. Sadler after all. I didn't want the stink and the queasiness of Dr. Sadler's sulfa tablets, but anything would be better than kneeling beside the woodpile, trying not to scream, while my prick was reporting that it had apparently been doused with coal oil and set afire. Then, as I was swallowing aspirin in our kitchen and listening to Jan snore lightly in the other room, I remembered that today was the day William Wharton was scheduled on the block, and that Brutal wouldn't be there. The roster had him over on the other side of the prison, helping to move the library and some leftover infirmary equipment to the new building. One thing I didn't feel right about, in spite of my pain, was leaving Wharton to Dean and Harry. They were good men, but Curtis Anderson's report had suggested that William Wharton was exceptionally bad news. "This man just doesn't care," he had written, underlining for emphasis. By then the pain had abated some, and I could think. The best idea, it seemed to me, was to leave for the prison early. I could get there at 6, which was the time Warden Moores usually came in. He could get Brutus Howell reassigned to E Block long enough for Wharton's reception, and I'd make my long overdue trip to the doctor. Cold Mountain was actually on my way. Twice, on the 20-mile ride to the penitentiary, that sudden need to take a leak overcame me. Both times I was able to pull over and take care of the problem without embarrassing myself. For one thing, traffic on country roads at such an hour was all but non-existent. Neither of these two voidings was as painful as the one that had taken me off my feet on the way to the privy, but both times I had to clutch the passenger side door handle of my little Ford coupe to hold myself up, and I could feel sweat running down my hot face. I was sick, all right, good and sick. I made it, though, drove in through the south gate, parked in my usual place, and went right up to see the warden. It was going on 6 o'clock by then. Miss Hannah's office was empty. She wouldn't be in until the relatively civilized hour of 7, but the light was on in Moore's office. I could see it through the pebbled glass. I gave a perfunctory knock and opened the door. Moore's looked up, startled to see anyone at that unusual hour, and I would have given a great deal not to have been the one to see him in that condition, with his face naked and unguarded. His white hair, usually so neatly combed, was sticking up in tufts and tangles. His hands were in it, yanking and pulling when I walked in. His eyes were raw, the skin beneath them puffy and swollen. His palsy was the worst I had ever seen it. He looked like a man who had just come inside after a long walk on a terribly cold night. "Hal, I'm sorry. I'll come back," I began. "No," he said. "Please, Paul, come in. Shut the door and come in. I need someone now if I haven't needed anyone in my whole life. Shut the door and come in." I did as he asked, forgetting my own pain for the first time since I'd awakened that morning. "It's a brain tumor," Moores said. "They got X-ray pictures of it. They seemed real pleased with their pictures, actually. One of them said they may be the best ones anyone's ever gotten, at least so far, said they're going to publish them in some biggity medical journal up in New England. It's as big as a lemon, they said, and way down deep inside where they can't operate. They say she'll be dead by Christmas. I haven't told her. Can't think how. I can't think how for the life of me." Then he began to cry. Big, gasping sobs that filled me with both pity and a kind of terror. When a man who keeps himself as tightly guarded as Hal Moore's finally does lose control, it's frightening to watch. I stood there for a moment, then went to him and put my arm around his shoulders. He groped out for me with both of his own arms like a drowning man and began to sob against my stomach, all restraint washed away. Later, after he got himself under control, he apologized. He did it without meeting my eyes, as a man does when he feels he has embarrassed himself dreadfully, maybe so deeply that he can never quite live it down. A man can end up hating the fellow who has seen him in such a state. I thought Warden Moore's was better than that, but it never crossed my mind to do the business I had originally come for, and when I left Moore's office, I walked over to E Block instead of back to my car. The aspirin was working by then, and the pain in my midsection was down to a low throb. I would get through the day somehow, I reckoned, get Wharton settled in, check back with Hal Moore's that afternoon, and get my sick leave for tomorrow. The worst was pretty much over, I thought, with no slightest idea that the worst of that day's mischief hadn't even begun. Chapter 11.
"We thought he's still doped from the tests," Dean said late that afternoon. His voice was low, rasping, almost a bark, and there were blackish-purple bruises rising on his neck. I could see it was hurting him to talk, and thought of telling him to let it go. But sometimes it hurts more to be quiet. I judged that this was one of those times, and kept my own mouth shut. "We all thought he's doped, didn't we?"
Harry Terwilliger nodded. Even Percy, sitting off by himself in his own sullen little party of one, nodded. Brutal glanced at me, and for a moment I met his eyes. We were thinking pretty much that same thing, that this was the way it happened. You were cruising along, everything going according to Hoyle, you made one mistake, and bang, the sky fell down on you. They had thought he was doped. It was a reasonable assumption to make, but no one had asked if he was doped. I thought I saw something else in Brutal's eyes as well. Harry and Dean would learn from their mistake, especially Dean, who could easily have gone home dead. Percy wouldn't. Percy maybe couldn't. All Percy could do was sit in the corner and sulk because he was in the shit again. There were seven of them that went up to Indianola to pick up Wild Bill Wharton. Harry, Dean, Percy, two other guards in the back, I've forgotten their names, although I'm sure I knew them once, plus two up front. They took what we used to call the stagecoach, a Ford panel truck which had been steel-reinforced and equipped with supposedly bulletproof glass. It looked like a cross between a milk wagon and an armored car. Harry Terwilliger was technically in charge of the expedition. He handed his paperwork over to the county sheriff, not Homer Kribus, but some other elected yokel like him, I imagine, who in turn handed over Mr. William Wharton, Hellraiser extraordinaire, as Delacroix might have put it. A Cold Mountain prison uniform had been sent ahead, but the sheriff and his men hadn't bothered to put Wharton in it. They left that to our boys. Wharton was dressed in a cotton hospital johnny and cheap felt slippers when they first met him on the second floor of the general hospital, a scrawny man with a narrow, pimply face and a lot of long, tangly blonde hair. His ass, also narrow and also covered with pimples, stuck out the back of the Johnny. That was the part of him Harry and the others saw first, because Wharton was standing at the window and looking out at the parking lot when they came in. He didn't turn, but just stood there, holding the curtains back with one hand, silent as a doll, while Harry bitched at the county sheriff about being too lazy to get Wharton into his prison blues, and the county sheriff lectured, as every county official I've ever met seems bound to do, about what was his job and what was not. When Harry got tired of that part, I doubt it took him long, he told Wharton to turn around. Wharton did. He looked, Dean told us, in his raspy bark of a half-choked voice, like any one of a thousand backcountry stampeders who had wound their way through Cold Mountain during our years there. Boil that look down, and what you got was a dullard with a mean streak. Sometimes you also discovered a yellow streak in him once their backs were to the wall, but more often there was nothing there but fight and mean, and then more fight and more mean. There are people who see nobility in folks like Billy Wharton, but I'm not one of them. A rat will fight, too, if it is cornered. This man's face seemed to have no more personality than his acne-studded backside, Dean told us. His jaw was slack, his eyes distant, his shoulders slumped, his hands dangling. He looked shot up with morphine, all right, every bit as cuckoo as any dope fiend any of them had ever seen. At this, Percy gave another of his sullen nods. "Put this on," Harry said, indicating the uniform on the foot of the bed. It had been taken out of the brown paper it had been wrapped in, but otherwise not touched. It was still folded, just as it had been in the prison laundry, with a pair of white cotton boxer shorts poking out of one shirt sleeve and a pair of white socks poking out of the other. Wharton seemed willing enough to comply, but wasn't able to get very far without help. He managed the boxers, but when it came to the pants, he kept trying to put both legs into the same hole. Finally, Dean helped him, getting his feet to go where they belonged, and then yanking the trousers up, doing the fly, and snapping the waistband. Wharton only stood there, not even trying to help, once he saw that Dean was doing it for him. He stared vacantly across the room, hands lax, and it didn't occur to any of them that he was shamming. Not in hopes of escape, at least I don't believe that was it, but only in hopes of making the maximum amount of trouble when the right time came. The papers were signed. William Wharton, who had become county property when he was arrested, now became the state's property. He was taken down the back stairs and through the kitchen, surrounded by blue suits. He walked with his head down and his long-fingered hands dangling. The first time his cap fell off, Dean put it back on him. The second time, he just tucked it into his own back pocket. He had another chance to make trouble in the back of the stagecoach when they were shackling him, and didn't. If he thought, even now I'm not sure if he did, or if he did how much, he must have thought that the space was too small and the numbers too great to cause a satisfactory hoorah. So on went the chains, one set running between his ankles and another set, too long, it turned out, between his wrists. The drive to Cold Mountain took an hour. During that whole time, Wharton sat on the left-hand bench up by the cab, head lowered, cuffed hands dangling between his knees. Every now and then he hummed a little, Harry said, and Percy roused himself enough from his funk to say that the lagoon dripped spittle from his lax lower lip, a drop at a time, until it had made a puddle between his feet, like a dog dripping off the end of its tongue on a hot summer day. They drove in through the south gate when they got to the pen, right past my car, I guess. The guard on the south pass ran back the big door between the lot and the exercise yard, and the stagecoach drove through. It was a slack time in the yard, not many men out, and most of them hoeing in the garden. Pumpkin time, it would have been. They drove straight across to E Block and stopped. The driver opened the door and told them he was going to take the stagecoach over to the motor pool to have the oil changed. It had been good working with them. The extra guards went with the vehicle, two of them sitting in the back, the doors now swinging open. That left Dean, Harry, and Percy with one shackled prisoner. It should have been enough, would have been enough, if they hadn't been lulled by the stick-thin country boy standing head down there in the dirt with chains on his wrists and ankles. They marched him the 12 or so paces to the door that opened into E Block, falling into the same formation we used when escorting prisoners down the Green Mile. Harry was on his left, Dean was on his right, and Percy was behind, with his baton in his hand. No one told me that, but I know damned well he had it out. Percy loved that hickory stick. As for me, I was sitting in what would be Wharton's home until it came time for him to check into the hot place. First cell on the right as you headed down the corridor toward the restraint room. I had my clipboard in my hands and was thinking of nothing but making my set little speech and getting the hell out. The pain in my groin was building up again, and all I wanted was to go into my office and wait for it to pass. Dean stepped forward to unlock the door. He selected the right key from the bunch on his belt and slid it into the lock. Wharton came alive just as Dean turned the key and pulled the handle. He voiced a screaming, gibbering cry, a kind of rebel yell that froze Harry to temporary immobility and pretty much finished Percy Wetmore for the entire encounter. I heard that scream through the partly open door and didn't associate it with anything human at first. I thought a dog had gotten into the yard somehow and had been hurt, and perhaps some mean-tempered con had hit it with a hoe. Wharton lifted his arms, dropped the chain which hung between his wrists over Dean's head, and commenced to choke him with it. Dean gave a strangled cry and lurched forward into the cool electric light of our little world. Wharton was happy to go with him, even gave him a shove, all the time yelling and gibbering, even laughing. He had his arms cocked at the elbows, with his fists up by Dean's ears, yanking the chain as tight as he could, whipsawing it back and forth. Harry landed on Wharton's back, wrapping one hand in our new boy's greasy blonde hair and slamming his other fist into the side of Wharton's face as hard as he could. He had both a baton of his own and a sidearm pistol, but in his excitement drew neither. We'd had trouble with prisoners before, you bet, but never one who'd taken us by surprise the way that Wharton did. The man's slyness was beyond our experience. I had never seen its like before and have never seen it again. And he was strong. All that slack looseness was gone. Harry said later that it was like jumping onto a coiled nest of steel springs that had somehow come to life. Wharton, now inside and near the duty desk, whirled to his left and flung Harry off. Harry hit the desk and went sprawling.
"Hee-wee, boys!" Wharton laughed. "Ain't this a party now? Is it or what?"
Still screaming and laughing, Wharton went back to choking Dean with his chain. Why not? Wharton knew what we all knew. They could only fry him once.
"Hit him, Percy! Hit him!" Harry screamed, struggling to his feet, but Percy only stood there, hickory baton in hand, eyes as wide as soup plates.
Here was the chance he'd been looking for, you would have said, his golden opportunity to put that tallywhacker of his to good use, and he was too scared and confused to do it. This wasn't some terrified little Frenchman or a black giant who hardly seemed to be in his own body. This was a whirling devil. I came out of Wharton's cell, dropping my clipboard and pulling my .38. I had forgotten the infection that was heating up my middle for the second time that day. I didn't doubt the story the others told of Wharton's blank face and dull eyes when they told it, but that wasn't the Wharton I saw. What I saw was the face of an animal. Not an intelligent animal, but one filled with cunning and meanness and joy. Yes, he was doing what he had been made to do. The place and the circumstances didn't matter. The other thing I saw was Dean Stanton's red, swelling face. He was dying in front of my eyes. Wharton saw the gun and turned Dean toward it, so that I'd almost certainly have to hit one to hit the other. From over Dean's shoulder, one blazing blue eye dared me to shoot.